I sleep better at night, you know, for knowing that somewhere in the world, a twangy guitar is being twanged. Fang remains the fang.
Tja, dieses rasante Liedchen werden wohl die wenigsten von euch gekannt haben.
Well, if you ever see that on a 45, I'd snap it up, is my recommendation.
Diejenigen in Deutschland, die es kennen, kennen es wahrscheinlich als Intro zu der wöchentlichen Musiksendung, die ein gewisser John Peel seit den 70er Jahren für den britischen Soldatensender BFBS rund um die Welt produziert und moderiert. Liebenswert ist Peel vor allem, aber nicht nur, wegen vielfältigster und stets äußerst geschmackvoll ausgewählter Musik. Insbesondere wirkt er auch immer dann sehr sympathisch, wenn er sich über das Showgeschäft lustig macht oder skurrile Anekdoten erzählt, zum Beispiel von seiner Frau Sheila, die er jovial The Pig nennt, oder seinen vier Kindern. Mittlerweile ist er 60 geworden und nimmt die Sendungen in einem kleinen Studio auf seinem Landsitz auf. Unikum, das er in der weltweiten Rundfunklandschaft wohl ist, heißt jene zweistündige Sendung auch schlicht John Peel's Music on BFBS, nachdem der frühere Name Rock Today irgendwann anfing, sich peinlich anzuhören. Dass John Peel's Music on BFBS nur eine seiner mannigfaltigen Rundfunk-DJ-Aktivitäten ist, werdet ihr in der nachfolgenden Sondersendung, die ihr gerade hört, noch mitbekommen. Beispielsweise arbeitet er seit Mai an einem musikalischen Jahrhundertrückblick, den irgendwelche albernen Kollegen von ihm, etwas zu seinem Missfallen allerdings, The Peelennium getauft haben. Für diesen Rückblick sucht er seit Mai, wie gesagt, für jedes der 100 Jahre vier besonders hörenswerte Musikstücke heraus. Es ist wohl kaum übertrieben zu sagen, dass ohne den Altmeister wohl auch die freien Radios, speziell deren Musiksendungen, nicht in der Form denkbar wären, in der ihr sie kennt und schätzt, zum Beispiel Verstärker oder Hörsturz auf Querfunk. Feiert nun mit uns John Peels 60. Geburtstag, der eigentlich erst am morgigen Montag, dem 30.08.99, begangen wird. Die Sendung besteht heute aus drei Teilen.
Now the sneeze, I got an awful feeling. Hold on a second. They always say if you just press really hard underneath your nose, you won't sneeze. A little home help for you.
Im ersten Teil erzählt John Peel uns einfach aus seinem bisherigen Leben. Übrigens ist alles auf Englisch, er kann kein Deutsch.
About to sneeze, I've got an awful feeling. It's my birthday this week, and my thanks to all of the people who said I'm going to sneeze. Hold on. Oh, very unprofessional.
Im zweiten Teil wird es ausführlicher um seine Aktivitäten als Radio-DJ gehen und es wird viel über Musik geplaudert werden.
Oh, heavens, I was sneezing. Hold on, I'm going to do it again. Dear.
Im dritten und letzten Abschnitt wird er schließlich noch ein paar persönliche Einschätzungen in politischen Dingen und Ähnlichem abgeben. Da hat er eigentlich noch nie ein Geheimnis draus gemacht. Zwischendurch wird immer mal wieder ein Stückchen Musik zu hören sein, natürlich. Querfunk wäre natürlich nicht Querfunk, wenn wir nicht speziell für dieses Jubiläum in der Lieblingsmusik des Jubilars aus verschiedenen Jahrzehnten gestöbert hätten. Es werden zu hören sein The Misunderstood von ungefähr 1968, The Undertones von ungefähr 1978, sogar genau von 78, Carcass von 1988 und Melt Banana von 1998. Im Hintergrund wird übrigens die meiste Zeit seine Lieblingsband The Fall laufen.
Ist eine Band, die John Peel in England groß gemacht hat. Und um diesen John Peel geht es. Den großen alten Mann, den großen jung gebliebenen Mann des Independent Sounds, den größten DJs, DJ weit und breit wahrscheinlich, 30 Jahre bei der BBC. Es ist mir eine Ehre, heute Abend die letzten Worte mit diesem John Peel teilen zu können.
John Peel, oder wie er richtig heißt, John Robert Parker Ravenscroft. Im Herbst 1967 startet die BBC London ihr Popprogramm Radio One. John Peel ist DJ der ersten Stunde und mit 28 Jahren der jüngste DJ noch dazu. Zur Hippie-Zeit hat er in Amerika Flower Power ins Radio geholt, beim Piratensender Radio London im Untergrund gesendet. 1967 darf er den Untergrund ins BBC-Radio holen. This is not a love. Nach Mark Bolan, David Bowie und Rod Stewart musste was Neues her. Die Hörer regten sich gar nicht mehr drüber auf. Punk, die Ramones, Reggae, das waren willkommene Abwechslungen. Oder die Smiths, Susie and the Banshees oder die Happy Mondays. Plattenfirmen bringen Platten raus, weil die Band bei John Peel aufgetreten ist. Oder John Peel veröffentlicht gleich selbst die Peel Sessions. Die allerdings, im Gegensatz zu MTV Unplugged, auch mit völlig unbekannten Bands oder Eintagsfliegen, aber mit viel Rock'n'Roll. Seine Leidenschaft. Die Hobbys des heute 58-Jährigen, seine Familie, Schallplatten, Fußball. Familie hat er eine, Schallplatten hat er so 20.000, Tendenz steigend, und dem Fußball hat er die Vornamen seiner Kinder gewidmet, die alle Namen berühmter Liverpooler Spieler tragen.
Ihr werdet im Folgenden Versatzstücke aus zwei verschiedenen Interviews hören. Eines vom FSK, vom Freien Senderkombinat in Hamburg, das unsere Kolleginnen und Kollegen vom dortigen Freien Radio 1996 geführt haben. Sie sind es übrigens auch, die dem Querfunk monatlich die speziell für die Freien Radios in Deutschland produzierten Sendungen von John Peel zur Verfügung stellen. Seit nunmehr 2 Jahren, jeder vierte Samstag um 18 Uhr. Das andere Interview ist vom Westdeutschen Rundfunk 1997, als ein relativ durchschnittlicher Mensch, wir haben seine Stimme schon gehört, in Schulenglisch den Altmeister interviewen durfte. Die unzureichenden Übersetzungen werden hier allerdings weniger aus Zeitgründen weggelassen, bis auf ein paar typische Schnitzer des dümmlichen Berufsjournalismus.
Ich saß nebenan im Studio, in dem Studio, aus dem Jürgen Domian seine Talkshow sendet. John Peel saß in London in einem anderen Studio und man muss dann immer die Leitung checken, gucken, ob alles funktioniert. Und ich fragte ihn so einfach, um mal ein bisschen so die Modulation zu prüfen. John, wie war das so? Hast du gut geschlafen? Und er sagte, nein, das war furchtbar. Ich hatte eine ganz nasse Bettdecke und als ich dann um 4 Uhr wach wurde, dann merkte ich, die Matratze war auch nass. Das war ein schlechtes Hotel. Und dann bin ich aufgestanden, bin ins Büro gegangen, habe mir einen Tee gekocht und habe Platten gehört. Und der Tag war in Ordnung. So ist er, dieser John Peel.
Ja. Querfunk bittet auch, die etwas mangelhafte Tonqualität zu entschuldigen. Wie gesagt, entschuldigt bitte die etwas mangelhafte Tonqualität. Wir haben unser Bestes zu leisten versucht.
You have been warned.
Viel Vergnügen in den nächsten 2 Stunden wünscht Querfunk. Paperback Writers.
Yeah.
You once said, John, that the idea of your idea of the John Peel radio show goes back to the time when you were a little boy, 11 years old. What kind of idea was that?
Well, I used to listen to the American Forces Network in Europe, actually, coming from Stuttgart, and also to Radio Luxembourg, and just thought that I would like to do a radio program on which I played records that I liked, and because I assumed, rather naively, that that's what DJs did, you know, that they weren't driven by commercial pressure. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I was born the end of 1939 and grew up listening to American Forces Network in Europe, mainly from Stuttgart, and also to Radio Luxembourg and, of course, to the BBC. And
where have you been born?
In a, just out, well, it's a small village called Heswell, but it's near Liverpool. And as I say, I listened to a lot of radio when I was a child, and I liked music from a fairly early age, and because my family couldn't think what else to get me for Christmas and birthday, they used to just get me records, and in those days, they'd just go to a shop and buy, like, a record, you know, because I didn't have any kind of, I didn't say I want records by such and such a person. And so I thought, after a while, because we lived in the country, and it was a fairly remote area, so I didn't know very many people, and I thought how nice it would be to have a job on the radio playing records. And I know this sounds like an oversimplification, but that's what I wanted to do, and that is of course what I now do. It took a while to get into a position where I could do that, but after I'd finished my own military service when I was 18, 19 years old, I went to America, to Dallas, Texas, and within about a year I had a part-time job on a radio station in Dallas playing rhythm and blues records, a program called Cat's Caravan, of course, spelt with two K's, inevitably. I did that for a very short period of time, and I thought it was, they probably asked me to do it because of my extraordinary knowledge of the blues, but I think that they probably asked me to do it because, by American standards anyway, I had such an amusing accent. And so which is, you know, any reason for being on the radio is fine. So, but then I asked them to start paying me, and they weren't prepared to do that, so we went our separate ways. But then, when the Beatles came along, of course it was enormously fashionable to be from the Liverpool area, and because Americans are charming and generous people in general, I found, but they have a rather alarming ignorance of what the rest of the world is like. I mean, they often don't really know what goes on in the next state. So you'd meet people, for example, who were running businesses quite successfully, who seemed articulate and clever people, and that you'd say to them that you were from England, and they'd say, England? Is that in France? And he said, no, England's not really in France. It's quite close, though, you know. And I mean, they really knew amazingly little. And by an extraordinary coincidence, it seemed that a great number of them, the older men, had served in Europe during the war and had been stationed in England. And there's a county called Leicester, but it's spelled Leicester. So all of these Americans would say, hey, John, listen, we were in your Leicester during the war. We met this guy, Bill. Do you know Bill from Leicester? And you'd have to say that, by and large, you didn't actually know Bill from Leicester. And they'd be very disappointed at this. And so anyway, when the Beatles came along, I kind of capitalized on this naivety. And I didn't say that I did know the Beatles, but then I didn't say that I didn't. So, and they assumed that because I came from the same part of the world, that if I wasn't related by blood, I must be a very good friend. Yes. So I got a job as a Beatle expert on the radio station KLIF in Dallas. That was part-time as well. And after about 6 months of that, I was then offered a full-time job by a radio station in Oklahoma City, and went and worked there for 18 months. Another 18 months in California,
And then I got married in the meantime to a 15-year-old girl, which is like the sort of start of a country and western song. But and it was a bit of a mess, and she got me fired from the radio station, because if any women wrote to me or phoned up the radio station, she used to go around and threaten them, and the radio station didn't like this much. So I lost my job, and I came back to Britain, and went to work for one of the pirate radio stations, Radio London, which was run by a bunch of Texan businessmen, curiously enough. And but
how did you know
them? Oh no, I didn't know them at all. No. I don't think anybody did. You know, they just financed it from Midland, Texas, and took the money from it. And so on. But I went out onto the ship, and as I said, this first marriage was a bit of a disaster, and I wasn't enjoying it much. So I was quite grateful to have the opportunity to be on a ship for 2 weeks out of three, because when I'd been in California, my wife, who's now dead, poor woman, she had an awful life, but she put me in hospital a couple of times. And in a macho culture like that you find in California, you know, when you wake up in a hospital bed and they say, "What are you in here for, fella?" And you say, "My wife beat me up." You know, it's, people used to take the piss a bit. But anyway, so it was on Radio London, and at that time, I mean, it's difficult to, you know, it's difficult to convey the kind of innocence of it all, you know. And I suppose everybody, as they grow older, regards the period in which they grew up as being an innocent time. But it was much more innocent, and in that, if
what
nothing
else, innocent mean?
Well, it was very simple, you know, and life was, because there were far fewer options available to you. You know, life was kind of, you knew what was going to happen most of the time. For example, in the area of clothing, for example, everybody, whether they were running the country or whether they were digging roads, all wore kind of grey trousers and black shoes and grey socks and you know, white shirt and a waistcoat and a waistcoat and a dark jacket. So you'd see people digging the roads, you know, sort of really quite smartly dressed. And if you'd wanted to buy a shirt like yours, you'd have had to fly to Naples to buy it. You know, I mean, you couldn't. You know, there's no way that you could find anything like that.
Oh
well, of course, that's what I'm saying. Things things have changed a great deal, you know, since those days. But what I'm saying is, so something like pirate radio came into the kind of quiet backwater of British cultural life and had an extraordinary impact on people, and people became very quickly dependent on it, you know, because the BBC offered no comparable service. Mm. And it was at that time instrumental in supporting, at least domestic, in fact, because the signals went over all over Europe. I mean, on Radio London I used to get letters from people who'd heard the programme in Cyprus, you know, so.
Der Beginn seiner eigentlichen Laufbahn ist mit der Band The Misunderstood verbunden. 1968, The Misunderstood.
Seven hours I was in, for I'm dead, yes I Which has been the motivation of this Texas?
Oh, to make money. I mean, there's no ideology. Yeah, so there's no ideology attached to it at all. It's just a money-making operation. But when I got out there, because I was the junior person on the station, I had to do two programs each day, and I would do a daytime program, which was full of advertisements and, you know, and a lot of good records. I mean, you know, in the late 1960s, there were a lot of good singles around. And I also had to
featured the music from that time, some aktuell, at the moment.
Yes, contemporary. Yes, oh, very much so, yes, you know. And I mean, they picked it all in the office in London, you know, so the records would arrive and there'd be a sticker on them saying, this is your pick for the week, you know, so you weren't allowed to listen to records and say, I really like that, I'll make that one. They chose it all for you. But I mean,
who was it that chose it?
A man called Alan Keane, I think, who's unknown to you, I bet. I mean,
and what was his job?
Well, I mean, he was just station manager, I think. Frankly, I'm not even sure who did choose the records, but they chose them pretty well, you know, so the station did sound good, and most of the, you know, a lot of, Radio London and Radio Caroline were very close to each other geographically in the water, and so occasionally people would row across from one boat to the other, and which was quite romantic, and their playlist was about the same as ours, but sufficiently different for people to be, you know, switch from one to the other. There's a lot of good music around, and the competition kept it pretty tight, and we got, for example, the first play in the world of Sergeant Pepper, so I was like the first person to play Sergeant Pepper on the radio, you know, and which was at the time was very important to me. But then the other program I had to do was from midnight to 2 o'clock in the morning, and after a while I realized that none of the people on the ship with me were listening to the program, and I rather suspected that none of the people at the office in London, because it was a very small staff, would be listening to it either. So I stopped running the advertisements, and I stopped reading the news and the weather, and just started playing records that I'd brought back from California, or things that I'd bought at sort of hip record shops in London. And the people who ran the station knew about it was when they got a phone call from Brian Epstein, the manager of the Beatles, to say, this is a great idea, you know, and what is a great idea? This program that John Peel's doing, which is called Perfumed Garden, said, this Perfumed Garden is wonderful. So they switched on to it, because they'd never heard it before, and they weren't very pleased, but at the same time, the station only had 2 or 3 months left to broadcast before it was closed down by the government, so they just let me get on with it. So when I and it was very popular, you know, because it was, I was playing, you know, Doors, Love, Velvet Underground, Pink Floyd, Incredible String Band, all of those things. So when the pirates' ships closed down in the early summer of 1967, the BBC intended to replace it with a pop music service, Radio One, and that started at the end of September in 1967, and it was a typical kind of BBC British establishment compromise, really, but it was better than nothing, and it still remains better than nothing, you know, it still has a lot of defects now, I think, but one of the elements built into the programs was, because of the agreement that the BBC had with the Musicians Union and the people responsible for music copyright and so on, there had to be in each program.
Musicians Union, what the GEMA is?
Well, it's no, but the music publishing thing is like GEMA, yes. The Musicians Union just is a trades union, you know, representing the interests of musicians. But it meant that into each program there had to be built live music. Which meant, in effect, music recorded in a studio at the BBC's expense, but the musicians would be paid as though they were playing live. And for most people, this, I mean, this, the, you'd have things, I mean, I've heard the German equivalent, I've listened at night and heard, I don't know if they're still going, I like to think that they are, the Radio Dance Orchestra of Baden-Baden, I've heard, playing kind of cover versions of popular hits of the day in a rather syrupy sort of way, and in this country there was the Northern Dance Orchestra, and, they would do cover. I even heard them do a cover version of a Hendrix number once, which is something that I've never really recovered from. but on the program I was doing, we decided that we would use this apparent disadvantage and get bands in to record stuff for the programs that they had never, you know, they might not have otherwise recorded, or you know, they might just record things from some forthcoming record, they might do a kind of work in progress, they might work with other musicians, you know, whatever. But, of course, the Musicians' Union wasn't very keen on this, because they saw this in some way as defeating the idea that, you know, they wanted it to be kind of established musicians doing. So we had to register all of the musicians with the Musicians' Union. It was just, it was, the whole thing was so bureaucratic. It did mean we'd have people like, almost everybody really, except the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, who were both at the time too big to do it, but everybody else did it, you know, The Who, Cream, Hendrix, Pink Floyd, all recorded stuff for the programmes. So, I mean, really, that's, in a sense, is all the story there is, and that continues to the present day in this very studio.
All these people, John, I mentioned, have they shown their gratitude?
Well, not really. I mean, nor would I wish them to, you know. I mean, if you're the editor of a newspaper, you don't expect the people who are involved in the news stories to write in and say, hey, listen, thanks very much for mentioning whatever it is that they did. People will give you the credit for having helped people to establish some kind of reputation, but it's not, again, something that I don't sit at home at, you know, in the evening and think, well, if it wasn't for me, that David Bowie wouldn't be making all the awful records he's making. And I mean, I just don't think like that. So it's not something that either bothers me or pleases me or anything.
Do radio for 30 years for one channel, for one organization. There must be a secret behind. Is there any?
Complete lack of ambition, I think, is probably the secret. I have the BBC gives me the opportunity to do exactly what I want to do, so there's no reason to go looking for something else.
John, some of your faves, in fact, like The Wedding Present, The Fall, seem to be a little bit out of fashion today when we talk about flavor of the month and these fast living things. Do you see any relevant interactions between fashion and music?
Well, they exist, I know this, but it's something which I've never really bothered about. Perhaps a little bit during the hippie days, but, you know, I'm a fat, bald, middle-aged man. Fashion means very little in my life. I live in the country, I don't even live in town.
Why did I do that? It is amazing how sometimes, you know, thoughts leave your brain, whatever part of your brain it is, in reasonably good shape. They reach your mouth and something unspeakable comes out. Anyway. Facial tissue in a breast bin at dawn. A ticket out of no
terrace. Face imprints. Right, that your children have names from football players?
They do, yes, but in a kind of respectful and moderate sort of way. My eldest son is William Robert. You'll have difficulty remembering all of these names, but William Robert Anfield. Anfield being the ground where Liverpool play. And Alexandra Mary Anfield is my 19-year-old daughter.
My 17-year-old son is Thomas James Dalgleish, after Kenny Dalgleish, who was perhaps not as famous in Germany as he should have been, but for me, he was the best footballer I've ever seen.
Kenny Dalgleish is here, where he's
going. Oh, fantastic. I mean, he was, because Scotland never did well in international competition, people never got the chance to really see him play, but he was amazing, I think. And then the youngest child, Florence, who is 15, she's named after Bill Shankly, the greatest football manager of all time, of course, as we all know.
Ein Fußball-Enthusiast, John Peel, und... Has anyone asked about... Papa, why do I have this name?
No, I think they're rather... I think Alexandra probably wishes that she wasn't called Anfield, but I think the rest are quite... honored to have these noble names, you know. It could have been much worse, let's be honest.
Also, es gab nur eine kleine Revolution.
I mean, you know, I think that the majority of the people who, to really answer your question earlier, which I didn't answer properly, I think the majority of people who listen to my programmes and who do bother to vote would almost certainly vote Labour. Mm. Or, yes, probably Labour. But I would say, because I think, I don't know the exact figures, but, yeah, you know, there's something like, in the last election, of voters between 18, which is the first time you can vote, to 24 or something like, 45% of them didn't vote at all. And...
of the young people.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you know about your audience?
Well, everything and not very much, you know. I mean, one of the things that I like... particularly about the programmes on BFBF, because when Radio 1 was set up, it was set up with the idea that the DJs who worked for the station were kind of celebrities, you know, and there's always been this celebrity dimension to the station. It's not as bad as it was, but I mean, the DJs who started on the station, they would have listeners, they'd have like 15 million listeners, you know, and more than that, because there wasn't anything else. And they were big stars, you know, if they went anywhere to open a shop or something, thousands of people would turn up. And having worked in America on the radio, where being a DJ was something rather disreputable, you know, that you didn't kind of admit to. People said, what do you do? Radio. And hope that they didn't ask you anymore, you know. And so, there's always been... what was the point I was going to make? Sorry, I lost my train of thought. It happens to you as you get older, these things. So DJs in those days were celebrities and very influential people. Uh-huh. And also about the politics, that's where we were, wasn't it? But the programmes that I do, I mean, I would like to believe that just the choice of music and so on, you know, would imply a kind of political belief and so on. But I mean, you don't really know who's listening to the programme. I mean, I know a lot of... I know a lot of the people personally, and that's one of the things that I liked about... I'm going doing this backwards now, but one of the things I liked about BFBS was that people who in Germany who listened to the programmes didn't realise that you were supposed to be a celebrity. So if they liked the programme, they kind of liked you by extension. So almost every weekend or every day I was doing a programme, German people would arrive here and say, hello, you know, we listen to your programmes, do you have time to go and have a beer and so on, which I really liked, because as a result of this, my address book is, even now, is still, you know, half, a third of the names in there are German names. Mm. And I really liked that. And they... And also for kind of, it meant a lot to me for reasons, you know, like cultural reasons, going back to the war and stuff like this, you know, when my father was away fighting, perhaps your father, in North Africa or something. And but then you know, you it was important to people of my generation to try and of a kind of liberal approach, her attitude, to try and understand, you know, why it was that my dad was fighting your dad, you know, and why my father was away until I was 6 years old, and a lot of my parents' friends didn't come back at all or died in bombing and stuff. But then, there was a kind of, and we weren't allowed to learn German in school, you know, which I regret because I'm still embarrassed by my inability to say almost anything in German at all. So there were kind of deep-rooted cultural reasons that even now I can't entirely explain that made me really pleased that the programs that I did for BFBS were popular in Germany. And it got to the point when we had so many German people coming to visit us that so many people turned up in the village pub and said, "Hello, we are from Hamburg, and we are for John Peel looking." And they must have thought that we were running some kind of strange kind. I don't know what they thought, but people were sort of puzzled by the vast numbers of Germans and Dutch people in particular who were coming into the village looking for our hat. This has meant a lot to me, really, and attached to the job. For example, on my 50th birthday, I wrote to 25 or 30 of the people who'd been writing to me over the years and who I'd not always met, and I'd say, I feel that I would like you to be at my 50th birthday party as much as anybody else, although we've never met. It'd be a nice opportunity for us to meet and so on. And I said, if you can bring a sleeping bag, we the room in the house, or if you can bring a tent, we can put it, there's a field across the road and there'll be people staying there, because a lot of people came, I'm not showbiz people much, but just friends, And what was really sad about it was that only three of the people that I'd invited turned up. And since then I've spoken to some of the others or written to them, and they said, well, they thought that in spite of everything that they knew about me from what I do and from what I'd said to them in letters, they assumed that it was still going to be like a show business event. Phil Collins was going to be there. "Hey, Phil, great to see you. Elton, you old bugger, how's it going, mate?" And they really thought it was going to be like that, in spite of everything. So that's kind of sad, I think, So I spent a lot of my time trying to break that down.
John Peel, der morgen 60 Jahre alt wird, der insistiert immer wieder darauf, dass Leute mit Hüten eigentlich nur schlechte Musik machen können. Eine Ausnahme akzeptiert er allerdings, Captain Beefheart.
The story in this club in Bond Street, John, when you have taken the kitchen door for the outdoor, is this a metaphor for something?
Well, it could be. You could work it up into a little metaphor for something. But the thing is that
I know a lot of people, particularly other DJs, who complain that they can't go anywhere without being recognised, but they go everywhere wearing a kind of tartan suit, you know, and carrying a guitar, and with a couple of Swedish women with them, without much clothing on, and, you know, so, I mean, you would notice them anyway, and they would be very disappointed if they weren't noticed, but I look like a taxi driver, you know, and a rather badly dressed taxi driver at that, and so when I went to this club, I was a bit of an embarrassment, yes. And Brian Ferry, who I heard you mention Brian Ferry, he had sat in our office and told us about Roxy Music and said that he hoped we would play their music on the radio, which we did. But when he saw me in there, in a kind of fashion context, he was obviously very embarrassed and didn't want to speak to me. But I wasn't offended. Genuinely thought it was very funny. I mean, I've told the story many times.
Nun wieder eine Frage aus Hamburg von unseren Kollegen von FSK.
Perhaps you will have one in Hamburg.
Well, I mean, I do programs for anybody. You know what I mean? I just none of these things. I mean, you know, well, put it this way: with the programs I used to do for Radio Bremen, given the fact that there's Germany, by and large, is a more prosperous country than most. But if, as often was the case, I didn't have the program ready in time to send it through the normal postal channels and had to kind of air freight it to Bremen, I lost money on the deal. You know, so it's never been a big money spinning thing. But that's not the point. So, like the last time, you know, when the manager of the station phoned up and said we're cutting it down from 5 hours to four. And I argued with him, and it's one of those things. I wrote him a letter about it, and 5 weeks later, he hasn't even bothered to answer my letter, which indicates the kind of way the mood is going. They just don't give a toss, really. But he said to me, "Well, you know, we'll look at the money. You know, we'll make sure that you get as much money and so on, and we'll give you a 2-year contract instead of a 1-year contract." And I said, "Well, that's very nice." I said, "You know, because at any age, you're grateful for an income and you're grateful for a degree of stability for 2 years." I said, "But those aren't the reasons." I said, "This is what you won't understand," because I was very pissed off at him. So I said, "This is what you," because previously, when he'd cut me from 5 hours to five and a half, he'd said, "You know, next time I'll make sure you get some time back." And I reminded him of this, and I said, "You know, I don't do this for money, and I don't do it for job security. I say, even after all of these years, there's still kind of traces of some kind of sad hippie ideology behind it all, you know." And I said, "It's really, it's that." I said, "It's not ego." I said, "You know, because I try to suppress that. I mean, you know, obviously there are times when people make a fuss of you and you feel good about it. There's nothing shameful in that. But I think having four children probably helps you to, you know, keep fairly stable, because obviously they just think you're a wanker, you know, because children do think their parents are wankers. They like me, I think, but not much more than that. I mean, they don't admire me, but who wants to be admired, really? So it's not a good time, and I found out a couple of weeks ago that the Finnish station that I work for, which is called, barely believably, Radio Mafia, they've had because I was one of the reasons I liked them. When they wrote me in the first place and said would I like to do a program for them, because their signal went over into the Baltic States. They put at the end of the letter, they said, "By the way, this will be the only chance you have in your life to be a star in Estonia." And I sort of liked the thinking of that. And they also had, they had a program that was called the Piss Fuck Program, which is like very Finnish, because they like, you know, they just, I don't know why they did this, but whenever I speak to them, they seem to be almost permanently drunk. I get the wrong impression about them. They seem very rowdy, and a bunch of people. And they phoned me up, because it used to be called Rock Radio. And they phoned me up, and John, we are having a meeting tonight. What a pity you can't be here. We have many beers, and you know, we talk about a new name for the station. And I said, well, you know, when you've made it up your mind, call me back and tell me what it is. And when they came on the phone, they said, we've decided to call it Radio Mafia. And I thought, come on, you know, you're taking the piss now. You're making fun of a nice old man here. But Radio Mafia it is. But even there, they've just had the amount of time that they can devote to anything other than chart music halved from 8 hours a week to 4 hours a week. So I've got, you know, a quarter. Well, actually, no, because it only goes out once every 2 weeks. I'm an eighth of the Finnish national output of music other than simply Red is down to me, which is weird because I don't speak Finnish, either. That's me kind of opening. You hear the what's that stuff called? It anyway, that stuff. Back in there, slam the door on it. This is professionalism at its very best. If you're looking for a career in radio, follow me.
We would be very glad to have some programs by you on our community radio station in Hamburg, FSK, as I wrote you, I think. Perhaps if you...
Well, I don't, how would... I mean, how would you, how would we do that sort of mechanically? I mean, because the only machine... I record them at home, and I just have a Revox. So you probably do everything on DAT and stuff, do you?
Of course.
But I've never I don't have a DAT machine. I don't even know how one works. You know. I stick with old technology until it no longer works. You know, and it's like I still write everything because I do a lot of writing as well, and I still write everything with a typewriter. You know, and people say, But people say you must get a electronic typewriter, you must get a word processor. And I said, but the typewriter works for me. I mean, I think at the speed at which I type. You know, if I use even an electric typewriter, I don't like the fact that you don't hear the whack of the key going up. If you hear it at all, you hear it about sort of half a second after you've done it. I like to be able to bang the key, up comes the thing, there it is, you know, there's an H, bang, there's a, you know, and that's the way I like things to be. Yeah. And as I say, so the only technology I've got is, this is what went wrong with the Austrian radio station, because they wrote to me and they said, you know, we like the programs very much, we want to continue with them, but we want you to have a band playing live each, because it's only once a month. I said, we want you to have a band playing live each week on the program. And also if you can do some sort of interviews with pop stars and things like this. So I wrote back and sent them a photograph of my studio and pointed out that, I mean, it's about a sixth of the size of this room. And it's not even a studio, it's not even got soundproofing in it. You know, it's just a corner of a room with a little desk in it and two turntables and a CD machine and a Revox. And I pointed out that... the idea, I mean, I might be able to get somebody who was like playing a guitar, an acoustic guitar, standing at the back of the room, you know, but the idea of getting a band to play in there was quite clearly not on. And even if I wanted to interview someone, because I insisted that they put the desk in front of the window so that I could see what was going on outside while I was doing the program, I said whoever was being interviewed would have to stand in the garden and I'd have to interview them through the window. Yeah, well, I thought so too, but I'm afraid the Austrians didn't see it in the same light at all. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to have a hard time persuading Morrissey to drive 150 kilometres into the countryside to stand outside in the garden. You know? So I don't think he's going to do it. So, but I mean, I'd be prepared, I'll try it. Yeah, you just tell me, you know, what you want and when you want it, and I'll do it. Dear, oh dear. But I really miss doing all that stuff that I love doing. I knew I was in trouble with Brayman when the head of Radio Brayman came round BFBS, and he was an impressively tidy man with a kind of military bearing, very, you know. And he came in, and I was introduced to him, and I said, "Oh, I believe I work for you." He said, "I do nothing, sir." And I said, yes. I said, I've been doing programs for Radio Bowman for 4 or 5 years now, and there must be some mistake. And I said, no. I said, I used to do a program called Mittags Pause and one called Ritz. And he said, we have these programs. And I said, well, I used to do them. I said, but now I do a program for Radio Bremen Fear. And he said, and he was obviously horrified. And he went back, and that was the, I think he must have gone back and said, we don't want this man. Because that was the last, I never did anymore after that. Well, I said, they didn't even have the courtesy to tell me that they weren't broadcasting them anymore. No. So it was just because I kept sending them.
That is absolutely impossible.
Yeah, isn't it? I used to send the tapes over there, and somebody wrote, you know, some friend in Bremen, and I said, why have they stopped broadcasting your programs? And I said, they haven't. He said, yeah, they have. And I said, I made inquiries, and I'd probably still be sending them if I hadn't heard from him. You know, yeah, very bad, I thought.
They talk a lot of wind, I'm real sick, I'm in distress, I got uptaken holes in my eyelids from watching all the wind. Ich hoffe, es bereitet euch genauso viel Spaß wie mir, John Peel hier zu lauschen bei seinem Geplauder. In der musikalischen Zeitreise sind wir jetzt 1978 angekommen, wie schon angekündigt. Hier ist bis auf den heutigen Tag sein Lieblingslied von den Undertones. Teenage Kicks natürlich.
So, jetzt geht es weiter auf Querfunk 104,8 MHz mit der Geburtstagssendung zum Thema John Peel, der morgen 60 Jahre alt wird. Nachdem er jetzt einiges, fast eine Stunde lang, aus seinem Leben geplaudert hat, geht es jetzt nochmal genauer zum Thema Musik und Radio.
Yeah.
gibt nur einen Mann, einen Mensch auf der Welt, der alle Veröffentlichungen von The Fall hat, und das ist John Peel. Dieser Name, The Fall, der fällt immer in Zusammenhang mit diesem britischen DJ.
Smart aleck titles, really, to imply that these are pretty thoughtful and clever people. Nothing wrong with that at all, but makes me envious, of course, and resentful. With things like "When in doubt, use Chinese handcuffs," and "Captivated by the zoo of your beauty," and so forth. You know, and I'm more of a kind of "She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah" man when it comes to titles.
John, you have seen, in fact, every big school of music, like rock and roll, art rock, hippie, punk, new wave, indie, and today as dance music. How do you see today's music, the current state of mind? Would you say that it's a healthy thing?
Oh, very healthy indeed. There's an awful lot of it. This is the only problem that I have. I get so many records to listen to each week that it is, even if I were to listen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I would still be steadily falling behind. So I do have records coming into the house which I know I'm not going to get the chance to listen to.
John, how do you manage to listen to all this dance stuff?
Well, I suppose I have a fairly... other people, I think, would probably find the way I work impossible, because it just goes on continuously. I mean, I do most of my work at home, and fortunately my family like the music also. My children like the dance music in particular. So I get up in the morning when they get up to go to school and start listening to records and have my breakfast as I listen to records and live my life listening to records. But that is much better than being down a coal mine, you know. I mean, it's what I like doing.
John, you once said that you can't fall asleep to house and techno when you are tired. That doesn't work for drum and bass. Does this say anything about the qualities of these genres?
I don't know, really. I can't remember. Perhaps I did say that. You know how sometimes you say waspish things in order to be amusing. I don't know. I can fall asleep to anything, really. It's one of the advantages of being a middle-aged man is that you have the capacity to fall asleep for half an hour in the afternoon and wake up feeling very much better.
What's your personal policy in choosing music for your
programs? Well, this is a question.
You make different programs with different. With a different policy, or...?
No, they're always just the same, really. Always the same, whoever I do them for. In fact, there used to be a time when... funnily enough, the only time... well, this will sound so stupid that you'll think I must be a little unbalanced, but... there was a time when, if you lived on the coast, roughly in the area of the Dutch-German border, you'd have been able to hear me, I think, on 6 different radio stations, because you'd have been able to pick up the BBC, you'd have been able to pick up BFBS, you'd have been able to pick up the BBC World Service, you'd have been able to pick up radio station that, what the hell was it called? I can't even remember. VPRO in Holland that I did a program for. And you'd have been able to pick up Radio Bremen Fear also. That's 5. So I used to think, there may be one person who's there who can hear all of these programs, and I used to try and vary the records for the benefit of that one person. And then it got so complicated, I think, this is really stupid, you know, because this person almost certainly doesn't exist. But apart from that, the music, is the same, really, whichever program I'm doing. And
but it changed through the years.
Of course, yes. I mean, so does the newspapers, you know. I mean, I I sometimes feel nostalgic, sometimes listen to old records, but not very, very often, because as with the newspapers, you know, that's last Saturday's newspaper, I don't feel the need to read it, you know, because I mean, I know what happened, but today's newspaper I would be interested in. And it's the same with the music, and I suppose the question that I've been asked most frequently over the years really is the one that you've just asked, you know, by what process do I choose the records that I want to play? And the answer to that is I really don't know. I mean, I listen to loads and loads and loads of records at home. I mean, it goes on constantly, I suppose, if you were to sit down and work it out, 50, 60 hours a day, a week rather, listening to, there'll be quite something in a day, actually, in a week listening to records, you know, and I do other things at the same time, like talk on the phone or eat or go to the toilet or something. But there's like music playing all the time. And as I'm listening to it, I think, well, that's a record I want to play on the radio. I don't want to play that one. And that's really the only process.
But I think there must be something characteristic for your programs. I was told that you're probably the first radio DJ who dared to play, for example, Yugoslavian wedding song. And
yes.
Then,
well, I like doing that. Yeah, because to me, yes. I mean, this is the problem at the moment. You know, is that now they want programs that are they want programs playing different music, but they want within that program the music to be all the same. Yeah. So you get a dance music program that's on before the one I do on Friday, and it's, you know, it's kind of the same from the moment it starts to the moment it ends. You know, I mean, it's all right. I listen to it, but it's there's no variation really within it.
Is it true that this is a characteristic of your programs, that they are not formatted?
No. Well, I hope not. No, I mean, the only limit is really the limit that the limitations that I have personally. I mean, the amount of time that I have on the air, but then also my ability to listen to new stuff, you know, so there's obviously a lot of great music being made that I'm never going to hear, and it's not going to get into the programs as a result. But the more I can hear, obviously, the more I like it, and the more I enjoy doing the programs. And of course, it does mean that I can, like the program before mine, I mean, on Friday, I always follow with a dance record and then go on into other things, and then it's followed by a rap program, so I can kind of go into it with some kind of rap or hip hop kind of based thing. And so I can do that, you know, and it seems like a logical programming thing to do. And I know, obviously, I don't put in something that I don't myself like, but of course, they couldn't possibly do the same thing, you know, because their format is so rigid. They couldn't say, oh, well, Peel's coming up next, so finish with like a remix of a Fall track or something. They just couldn't do that, you know, because it would. So, I mean, it seems to me that they are...
Are they forced to do so?
No, I think they're employed because that's what they do. You know, I think that for the time being, anyway, I mean, the amount of time that I have on the radio here in Britain is being cut back all the time. And I think it's largely... I think a lot of it is to do with kind of unspoken ageism, you know, where they just think it's uncool to have a 56-year-old bloke on the radio, you know, doing... But then... it's more to do with the fact that the programmes do have a wide range of music in them, and the current fashion is not for that. And so I used to have 8 hours a week on the radio, then six, then five and a half, then five, and next month four. So it's the signs aren't good. And as I say, I used to have programmes in Berlin and Bremen, and also in Austria and Portugal, and for a very short and bizarre time in the Lebanon, and now Finland, and the only one I've got left is Finland, because, and each time the programs have come off because they wanted to have a more narrow musical range in the programs.
Mm-hmm. Ah, delicious mouth of tea came along at exactly the wrong moment, that.
Well, they forsooth. Who is that interesting hack over there? By gad, verily.
What has been the difference between Radio London and Radio Caroline? You have been to both of them.
No, I mean, I didn't work for Radio Caroline, just for Radio London. But I think the basic difference was that on Caroline, it was a pay-for-play station. So if the record company or some management or something was prepared to pay the money, the record would get played on the radio. At Radio London, that wasn't the case. And obviously Radio Caroline was more had more of a kind of revolutionary spirit, or at least this was what the image makers would have you believe, although I felt that the kind of pay for play policy that they had rather negated any idea that they might be a sort of Che Guevara style guerrilla broadcasters. They obviously went on. Radio London meekly closed down when the Marine Offences legislation came into force in 1967, with Caroline staggered on for a few years.
Is this the reason for this image of Radio Caroline?
Well, I think so, and they also had, you know, they yes, it is, really, that's the short answer to that, is yes.
The kind of music was about the same.
Well, I mean, latterly, Radio Caroline's playlist became so obviously one, you know, pay-for-play station, so, that an awful... I mean, it became... You kind of like the idea of them still sitting there in the sea, you know, rocking away in the storms and stuff, but the music was got worse and worse, really.
Yeah. I think somebody's about to...
That's all right, interrupt as much as you like. Right, okay.
What kind of program did you broadcast in Dallas?
Oh, in Dallas it was just a standard, you know, the sort of top 40 station, and I didn't have any choice in the music at all. I did a bit in California in the last few months that I was in California, because you used to have to do a six-hour program at the weekend. Unimaginable now, but I mean, it was the only way that you got any time off, you know, because I mean, there weren't very many people working for the radio station. So you did a three-hour program every day, and you had to double up and do a six-hour program either on Saturday or Sunday. And but during the six-hour program, I started to broadcast an entirely fraudulent British chart, you know, because I would pick album tracks by the Yardbirds and John Mayall's Blues Breakers and things like this, and claim that they were in the British charts. And so I had this, as I say, completely deceitful British chart. And then myself and one of the other DJs on the station, a chap called Johnny Darren, who ended up on a big radio station in Los Angeles, but he and I decided that what we should do, because all it's the same thing as that you get. I mean, I used to have radio programs in Berlin and Radio Bremen Field. And it's always saddened me that I lost those programs, but I lost them because it seemed that the radio stations, the only way they felt that they could compete with a lot of other radio stations playing records by Simply Red was to play Simply Red records themselves, you know what I mean? So they, I mean, that's a simplification, but this seems to be what people do. And in the area where we were working in California, too many stations were playing the same records. Mm-hmm. So we went to the management and said, look, the way that we can make ourselves different is by not playing the same records as everybody else. I mean, there does seem to be a kind of logic in this, you know. And it's another one of those things that, funnily enough, I can see in, for example, the results of the annual poll in Specs magazine. I mean, I know it's not a kind of nationwide expression of love bordering on lust,
But the fact is that the programmes I do for BFBS usually end up with me being placed quite highly in the DJ charts in Specs magazine, and most of the other DJs that are in there tend to be club DJs anyway. So you'd think that somebody running a radio station somewhere would look at this and they'd think, well, here's this bloke, he's a, like, you know, 56-year-old bloke, lives in England, does his programmes in English, and yet here he is in Specs magazine's DJ poll. And you think, they said, why don't we get one of our people to do a program that plays the same sort of music? You know, logic would tell you that it'd be worth trying anyway. It's the thought I've always had, you know, is that, I mean, I myself want to hear things on the radio that I've not heard before, rather than hearing stuff that I've heard loads of times. So anyway, we went to the management of the station in San Bernardino and said, why don't we just play, you know, because nobody ever played tracks from LPs, I mean, at all, you know, and, I mean, he only played singles, and or nobody ever played, like, the B-sides of singles, or, you know what I mean, and we said, if we do this, you know, it'll be interesting for us, the station will establish its own identity, and it'll be terrific all around. And they kind of thought about it for a while, but then decided not to do it. So it was that gave me the idea to, first of all, to do the Perfumed Garden programme on Radio London, and then to do the programmes that I do now for the BBC.
The neighbours now are listening to this.
In the 70s, John, your show has been used as a cheap A&R department for the record industry. Is this an idea what a perfect radio show should be all about?
Well, it's certainly not a bad idea, I think. There are other programs now which have a similar sort of function. There's a program called The Evening Session, which is just before mine on the BBC, and that is more of a kind of an A&R thing, but it's more of a Britpop program, really, and Britpop has really never excited me very much.
Why you aren't interested in Britpop so much?
Well, I think it's because I've heard most of it before, you know. I'm 58 years old, so all of the bands that have influenced Britpop, you know, whether it's the Beatles or the Kinks or the Small Faces or the Who or whatever, I mean, they're all bands that I heard the first time around. So I suppose with Britpop, I thought, I don't dislike it, you know. There are bands that I quite like, and I listen to the records and so on, but I think, you know, it is very clearly influenced by the past, and I'm more interested really in what's coming up next.
Oh, hello, this is Dennis. That's the Hank.
Which band do you listen to? Which record from which bands? Is it Blur, or is it more Supergrass? Is it more Oasis?
Well, my children are very much into Blur and Oasis, and so of the two, I think I probably prefer Blur, and they did come during the summer and play a kind of secret gig in our garden for the BBC. There's 40 people there, which was 40 people and 3 dogs, actually, which was very exciting. But of those sort of bands, I think I prefer Pulp, really, but they probably don't quite qualify as a Britpop band. But
that's right. It was a nice evening, John, having Pulp in your garden.
It was Blur in the garden.
Blur in your garden, yeah.
It was fantastic because we had to. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and I said she could bring 5 of her friends, you know. But we had to keep it such a secret that that morning my wife had to phone their mothers and say, you know, your daughter must not go to school today. She has to come to our house, but I can't tell you why. And they trusted us enough to send their children down. It was a lovely afternoon. Yeah.
Like I told you, the first to carry over, ship half-dollar man, the Sky Calendar Bar Home speculates.
Smash the guitar, never let it twang. We'll be right back.
you have a cloud in your eye. What do you have a cloud in your eye?
What? Downstairs. Got my hat and my corny brown leather jacket. Streets.
What's the policy of the BBC? Some weeks ago I read a statement by Liz Forgan, the manager of BBC Radio and Broadcasting, and it sounded very idealistic what she said. She said there are things that matter more than ratings and...
Yes, this is
true? Is this really the policy of BBC? Or?
The short answer to that is no, not at the moment. I mean, what you get now is... there's always been a conflict in broadcasting between kind of ideology and commerce. Mm. Except now, because everything else is accelerated, these kind of two opposing forces are also accelerated. So it's a difficult time to be doing radio programs, because you're constantly they talk a great radio station. When you hear them describing the kind of radio station that they want to do, you think, that sounds terrific, I really want to hear that, and you switch it on and it's the same crap as before, you know. So you get these two opposing forces, and it's very difficult. And there is, of course, you know, a lot of idealism within the BBC, because it's not it's not compelled to do anything particularly by commercial forces, because there is no advertising. So there are programs like this, which like the ones I do, which, you know, and there are a lot of others as well, clearly, but which I don't think you'd be able to do in many other places, because I can just choose any band that I hear that I want to be recorded, and the BBC will record them and will broadcast them, and I can play any record that I want to play. And the management have never, so far anyway, interfered and said, well, we think you shouldn't be playing this, or we think you should be playing that. And these are freedoms which I doubt you'd get on any other radio station, really. So that's pretty good. But there is this kind of constant internal stress, you know, built into the system, and it's getting worse, really. It's not fun work. It's never been fun, really, working for it, because you've always felt that there's been kind of resentment of the freedom that you're allowed, but then they allow you the freedom. So,
do you have this freedom because it's the BBC, or also it's the BBC?
I think because it's the BBC, you know. I mean, when it was set up in back in the 1920s, it was supposed to be, you know. The whole idea was that it would avoid just playing always to the lowest common denominator. You know, that they would strive for a measure of excellence. But of course, in the early days, there was a lot of rather pompous talk about educating the uneducated. You know, and giving them, whether they wanted it or not, a lot of high quality broadcasting. Mm-hmm. And you know, those things, you can't really force those things on people.
What's the broadcasting system as a whole? There exists the BBC and the commercial stations, and is there anything else?
Well, now let's see. I mean, obviously there are more and more commercial stations coming into the market all of the time, and so many of them seem to really cancel each other out by just doing the same thing. And I had a drive last year from where I live, which is in the kind of southeast of England, and I drove up to Glasgow, and listening to pop FM radio stations as I went, and they were all just playing the same music, and they'd all got the same DJs talking with the same sort of kind of bubbly voice, you know, and they'd all got the same kind of terrible cliches and awful competitions and unfunny features, and it was all really rather depressing.
There are community radio stations, which I know, I think you said you were interested in, but they tend to operate on just sort of like a month at a time. You know, they're allowed a kind of a month of broadcasting as an experiment, but there aren't very many, I think, that are on the air permanently. And of course, the problem is, as with anything like that, it's the idea of it is good, and the people who work for them are very dedicated, and they do some good stuff, but nobody listens to them.
Mm.
You know, because it's not what people want, alas.
Mm. I think it's a different thing in the United States. California, for example, just a pickup foundation, radio stations, things like that.
Mm. You see, things are so much more extreme, really. I mean, obviously, we're getting that way in Europe now, but I always wonder, I mean, you know, the people who might listen to the radio stations that you're talking about, who do they vote for in American elections? Do you know what I mean? And when you look at the people who are submitted as candidates, from either the two parties seem to be virtually interchangeable anyway, and all of the people who are up there are deceitful, and you know, they'll say one thing in one state and then exactly the opposite in another state, and yet people still go mad for them and think they're wonderful. And you think, how do intelligent Americans cope with the extraordinary stupidity of American politics, you know? And of course it's getting the same in this country, really, where you know that a bald man will never win an election again, or a fat man. Because it's what you look like is much more important than what you say. And I think your Chancellor may be the last fat European politician. It's quite an exciting moment. That's an exciting period you're living through, I think.
Wie gesagt, das Interview ist schon ein paar Jährchen alt, 3 Jahre, glaube ich. Und nun zu einer der allerwichtigsten Fragen meines Erachtens, die nun Herrn John Peel gestellt wird.
Is there any reference from the music you choose to broadcast and politics or social process in society?
Well, I kind of think, I like to think that there is, yeah, but it's not stated, you know, it's implied rather than stated. I don't think it's up to me to try and persuade people how to vote or...
Your shows, you play a lot of German bands these days, most of them electronic avant-garde tracks, some of them come from Cologne. What do you consider to be the German music scene's biggest strength?
Well, I don't really break these things down into categories, if I can help it. I mean, I've for a lot of cultural reasons, and you know, because of my age and so forth, and because when I was a child, I was told, you know, obviously grew up being told that Germans were bad people, and I thought this cannot be the case, you know, it can't be just total wickedness, and it became sort of, it's one of those things I've never been able to explain well, and it's a difficult thing to say, but I've always wanted to have links with Germany, which is why I've done radio programs for various stations that are either heard in Germany or are German in origin, and it's just a cultural thing, you know, where it's been important for me to make that kind of contact. I'm not quite sure why. I can't explain it very well.
The FSK band, John, is a band that has done a lot of John Peel sessions, more than other bands, in fact. What is the special thing about this relation you have to this German band?
Well, it's just that I like the kind of humour that is involved in what they do. There's a kind of gentle humour, and
I liked the people as well, and whenever they came to London, and I stayed with a couple of them in Munich last year, and but they make fun of me a little bit, but that's fine. So they should. You know, I'm a ridiculous figure in some ways. So we have like an affectionate relationship, but also I love their approach to music and the fact that they were prepared to do a session of Beatles songs once, and then a session of yodeling songs, and you know, they're just will try anything. So I admire them for that, and I just like their attitude, and I like them as people.
Dear John, a Zwiefacher is an Eastern Bavarian dance that alternates between waltz and polka time. Here is our Hobo Zwiefacher about incest and trains.
Letters from listeners?
Very, very rarely. I mean, the programs that I do that are heard in Germany, it's interesting because the ones that I do that are supposed to be for British soldiers,
yeah.
I get no letters from British soldiers, but many letters from German civilians. But the programs that I do specifically for German radio stations, I get no letters at all. But this is a great puzzle to me. I don't understand that at all.
When you read from these letters in your shows, John, when there are German people writing you, you English, you make their names sound more English, more British, in fact. Why is that?
Well, it's the theory is, I think, that British Forces has to pretend that British Forces Broadcasting has to pretend that the audience is only a British service personnel, and they're not supposed to pay requests. This is something to do with licensing or with paying royalties on the records or something, I'm not quite sure. So I have to change the names into English names, so it's easy enough if they're Thomas, for example, you know, Thomas, they become Thomas or Tom, and you know, Peter, but Peter, and so forth. But if somebody's called Wolfgang, there is no English equivalent, you know, or, you know, Heinz Peter or something. So, I mean, you just have to hope that they will recognize in themselves from the content of the letter or the postcard. It's very silly, but that's the way it works. And some listeners have understood this system and have taken on the names, not just English names, but military ranks as well.
Well, it's ambers. It's fireworks.
Which I should add is that one of our best friends is a man in Hamburg called Gerhard Fuchs.
Yeah.
And he took on the name Gerald Fox and also the rank of Lance Bombardier, and he is a very lowly rank in the Royal Artillery, and he has been a Lance Bombardier longer, I should think, than any serving English soldier.
Fair crowd.
Ihr hört immer noch die Querfunk-Sondersendung, Querfunk-Spezial zu 60 Jahren John Peel. Morgen hat er Geburtstag, am Montag. Wir haben The Misunderstood von 1968 ungefähr gehört, dann 1978 die Undertones. Weiter geht es mit einer Lieblingsband, die für John Peel die Platte des Jahres 1988 aufgenommen hat. Hier sind Carcass. Nachdem wir etwas Persönliches über ihn gehört haben in der ersten Stunde des Programms und jetzt die letzten 40 Minuten Spezielles über Radio und Musik, noch ein paar politische Ansichten des Herrn John Peel.
John, when we look at Britain from the continental point of view, we used to have Sellafield, we used to see radioactivity in the North Sea, we used to see Thatcherism and bad meat. Today, I think there has to be a little bit of a change. You know, we have a new politics, we have Tony Blair, we have Britpop, last not least. Do you think that there is in Britain, there's a change, a new optimism, and do you listen to that on British records?
Interesting question. I should say that I never voted for Margaret Thatcher, nor would do in several lifetimes, and I don't eat meat either, so I can't be responsible for any of those things. But I suppose there is a kind of a new optimism, whether it's actually based on anything other than spin doctoring and the making of magic in a way. I'm not quite sure. I'm not entirely convinced by Tony Blair, although I do find him preferable. I mean, I voted Labour, but I always have done. But yes, I suppose there is an atmosphere of optimism. But I do think that more and more people now, that, you know, there is much talk about the European community and politicians debate this and everybody says, should we do this? But I think that younger people are already in their heads doing it. I think they're already European, you know. So while their parents argue about whether they're European, the children actually are. I mean, I've always felt European and I'm grateful for that.
Also er hat sich als europäischen Freigeist gerade charakterisiert, der John Peel.
What do the people vote that are listening to your programs?
I would imagine the vast majority of them don't vote at all.
Do you regret this? Or?
I do very much, yes, because I mean, I'm a lifelong Labour voter, and I don't much like
even now.
Well, because, I mean, I'd sooner have them than the Conservatives, because I think the Conservatives have done incredible harm to the kind of morality of the country, and in a lot of ways it's a very unpleasant place, and in a lot of ways, really from the moment that Margaret Thatcher's government was elected, I felt a bit like a foreigner in my own country. I really have. I felt completely. I mean, I never imagined for a moment, it shows you how much I know about politics, when she was running for election the first time, I never imagined for a minute, I thought, people are going to take one look at this woman and listen to for 5 seconds, and they will know that she'll do terrible harm if she ever gets elected. And then I was driving home listening to the early election returns coming in, and I just couldn't believe it. I was crying by the time I got home. I just, you know, it just seemed to me to be just nightmarish, and it has proved to be nightmarish, although she's hugely admired everywhere else, and which is obviously still got a lot of supporters in this country. But she made, the thing was that, you know, back in my dad, I mean, my dad was a lifelong Conservative voter, but the Conservative Party that he voted for was a sort of paternalist party, you know, and they might have had the wrong motives, but they, you know, they would have ensured that if people were ill, that they were looked after. If they were uneducated, they were educated at least up to a point, and if they were out of work, that their children would be fed and clothed and so on. But they would be doing this so that they would be fit to work in the factories and on their farms and so on, but at the same time they did ensure that people enjoyed a kind of reasonable life as far as was possible. I mean, these are huge generalizations, but Margaret Thatcher's extraordinary. And I think British people were at that time, again, it's a ludicrous generalisation, but were kind of compassionate and considerate, and we were considered so by other countries. You know, there's one thing which people used to tell me in America. People would say, "Oh, you know, it's like you haven't got as much money as us, but I mean, they're kind of compassionate people." But then Margaret Thatcher made it somehow acceptable for people who were healthy to despise people who were ill, people who were in work to despise people who were out of work, and people who were young to despise people who were old, and you know, all of those things, and really that's damage which is can never be repaired, I think, you know. So from that point of view, and I think another thing too was that back in the 1960s, there's another obvious thing, but back in the 1960s, everybody assumed, and I'm not a great one, I'm not one of those people who lives for the 1960s, want them to happen again. And I think a lot of the people who do only feel like that because they were young and attractive and, you know, and had a lot of fun and so forth. But in the 60s, the feeling was that whatever was going on at the time, life was going to kind of gradually, you know, relentlessly, remorselessly, over a period of time, just get better. And what was going to happen ultimately, nobody had any idea at all. But you just felt that life was going to improve, society was going to get better, and better and better and better. Whereas now, everybody accepts the fact that it is going to get slowly worse. And all you can do is try and make that downward process move slowly. You know. So, I mean, that is the great change for me in my lifetime, is the feeling, you know, optimism has been replaced with either pessimism or realism, depending on which way you look at it.
Was this party for you, for this your 30th BBC anniversary party? And is there, can you say that this letter from Tony Blair that you received, is this something that got into the waste paper basket or something that is on the wall at home?
Well, it's neither, really. It would be silly to throw it away, I think, as a kind of political gesture. But it's not on the wall, no. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not naive enough to believe that Tony sat down and wrote it. You know, what can I say to John? I'm sure he is a secretary, somebody wrote it and he signed it and so on, and that was a kind thought. But it's genuinely more the case that if somebody writes to me and says, you know, I heard your program for the first time and I really liked it and so on, that is really more important, I think.
This political gesture, John, I think it's hard to imagine that something like this would happen in Germany. It's hard.
I imagine Chancellor Kohl. He's not written to me yet. But, I'm waiting. You know, if he wants to sit down and write us a letter, I'd be very happy to hear from him. No, I can't imagine. But it's sort of part and parcel of the new, brighter Britain, you know. and it's glamorous and it's kind of exciting and, you know, and it's well-dressed and so forth. But I can walk out of this building when we stopped talking, and there are still people sleeping in the doorways, you know, and there are people, I mean, and the National Health Service is falling apart, and education is a disaster. You know, these things are still going on, so it's superficial so far, I think.
I do not like your tone. It has ephemeral, whinging aspects. It's a curse.
So, zum Schluss haben wir jetzt noch nach The Misunderstood aus den 60er Jahren, den Undertones aus den 70er Jahren von 1978, Carcass von 1988, die euch wieder aufgeweckt haben, noch die Platte des Jahres für John Peel 1998. Hier sind Melt Banana. Hier sind Melt Banana.
Strange noise in my stomach, incidentally, if you heard it. You've got particularly sensitive radios, and I apologise.
letzten Jahren auch immer wieder gern gespielt von John Peel. Source Direct aus London. Und nach den Privatanekdoten, den Schoten übers Musikgeschäft und den politischen Ansichten von John Peel ist die Sendung auch schon fast zu Ende. Eher zurückhaltend und sehr gern hat diese Sondersendung zum 60. Geburtstag von John Peel für Querfunk zusammengestellt und moderiert der Radiotrinker.
If you roll a silver dollar down upon the ground and it'll roll because it's round, a woman never knows what a good man she's got until she turns him down, down, down. Anyway, that's enough of that, I think.
Ritual in this show, John, that the guest, the one who is interviewed, has the last words, the famous last words. It's not so unnatural to you, but anyway, it's a ritual, so this is your time.
Right, well, in that case, I'd like to end on a fairly serious note and say, and this again will sound like showbiz nonsense, but it is very much from the heart, the relationship that I've had with a small number of German people as a result of the programs that I've done that have been heard in Germany has meant as much to me in my life as anything else that I've ever done, and that is quite absolutely true.
Also, das war nochmal ein versöhnlicher Abschluss, wie ich denke. Der Respekt von John Peel an uns liebenswerten und musikverrückten Deutschen
sollte das heißen. Mit dieser tatsächlich entstellenden Übersetzung. Unglaublich. Tschüss an euch und herzlichsten Glückwunsch an John Peel. Zum 60. Geburtstag am 30. August 1999. Und hier ist nochmal John Peels Lieblingslied.